This is the Policy Options Podcast. I'm Julia Bugel. The 2019 election campaign is underway. The parties have made major policy announcements, but so far, much of the commentary has focused on political bombshells. When we don't talk policy as much as we should, that's a shame. First, because the announcements leaders make are pretty good markers of their party's election strategy. But more than that, because whoever forms government is going to be making good on a number of these election promises. And a healthy policy debate is crucial for citizens looking to make informed political decisions. That's why, over the next several weeks, we'll be highlighting the policy issues on the campaign trail by covering the three panel discussions in Policy Options' new Election 2019 Breakfast Series. The events are being held in Ottawa, in partnership with the Max Bell School of Public Policy. They're also sponsored by the CBC, and this one will be broadcast by CPAC. To get the details and to register for the next two events, go to policyoptions.irpp.org. Today's panel explores emerging policy themes and features Mike D'Souza, Tasha Curran, and Jennifer Robson. Here's moderator Jennifer Ditchburn to introduce the panelists and the event.
So Jennifer Robson, you might recognize her from our event earlier in the spring. She's an associate professor at the Clayton H. Riddell Graduate Program in Political Management at Carleton. She has worked inside the public service and served, among other things, as a member of the advisory panel on tax expenditures to the Minister of Finance. And Tasha Curran is founder and CEO of Ellipsum Communications. And you probably recognize her as a regular commentator on public affairs programs, as a radio host. And next year, she's going to be lecturing at the Max Bell School. Wouldn't you be lucky to have her as a as a prof? And Mike D'Souza is an investigative producer with Global News, and he's been covering politics and energy and environment for the past 15 years at such outlets as the National Observer and the Post Media Network. So let's give our panel a warm welcome. So if you've been to our previous events, you know that we're not so interested in party fortunes, who's up in the polls, who's down in the polls. We really like to focus on policy. Now, over the last week, one of the dominant stories in the news was about Mr. Trudeau's blackface and brownface incidents in the past. And of course, there's been a lot of dissecting of that. Are the Liberals going to lose because of this and so on? But there is a policy dimension to that story that we had hoped to touch on first as the first part of this event today. Interestingly, I'll just, as a side note, the NDP so far is the only party that has a specific section in its platform that's about racism and systemic racism in the country. So just a point of interest, because we've all read all of the platforms and all of the various releases from the different parties. So I'll start off with a question for all of you. What kind of concrete policy responses could the parties have to deal with racism and discrimination in Canada? So I'll start with you, Jennifer.
I think that the broader issue does actually highlight some systemic issues with racism in the country. I mean, what was going on that the school in question at the time didn't see fit to pull a teacher aside and say this isn't okay? What made it okay for them to even put this in a public brochure to you know, publicize what they were doing? And I think a lot of that comes back to issues around inequalities in terms of economic opportunity, in terms of political representation, even in terms of cultural representation. So current government has tried to make some strides in terms of gender-based analysis plus.
Can you just explain?
Sure.
Maybe there's somebody here that doesn't know what gender-based analysis plus is
supposed to be. So if you study public policy at all, this is the wacky idea that perhaps things might be different for people depending on their individual characteristics. No, it's mind-blowing, isn't it? But that you might actually get better policy proposals, a better policy implementation if you're actually taking account of those individual differences at the time that you're designing the policy. Now, the GBA part, the G in that stands for gender, but the plus part is supposed to be looking at intersectionality as well. So thinking about issues around race, right, around ethnocultural minorities, around linguistic minorities, around what it's like for people who are immigrants to the country. So that has some promise, but only if we start getting more serious about that. Do you know in Canada we don't actually even do a good job of tracking, for example, race as a characteristic when we're evaluating or when we're measuring household assets and debts? So we don't even have a good sense of, like, what's the racial wealth divide the way that other countries do here. So there's that. I mean, the NDP has promised that they're going to be addressing some of these issues in terms of looking at racial wage inequalities. I haven't seen much else from the other parties at this point.
Sasha?
I think the focus that was on Mr. Trudeau's behavior kind of did miss perhaps an opportunity to have a greater conversation. I live in Toronto, and racism is a very hot button topic there on many levels, whether it's with the police force or within the public service or other areas. So conversations that are had do involve some of the things that you were talking about, i.e. a lens as to how do you best encourage both representation and participation in things like the police or in government structures for people who would be considered racialized and face discrimination, either at the hiring level or the education level. I think that what the government, first of all, it's not a question of lip service, but representation is very important. And in terms of candidates, in terms of seeking out and ensuring that there is a representation of what Canada's reality is the first order for all political parties. So they could have, I think, that even making that sort of statement or tying it to that could have been a positive step that was probably missed. That said, though, I think one also has to address the issue of divisiveness. When we do talk about race, it is a divisive topic, a divisive subject. And as leaders, rising to the occasion and saying that, you know, we do not want this to become what it is in other countries, i.e. the United States, where the kinds of sometimes affirmative policies have actually received backlash. So I think that you have to see a kind of, a way of moving forward as a leader, and not necessarily simply the concrete stuff you were talking about, but the greater, I think, leading of a population of people to feel inspired to tackle these issues on a personal or a professional basis themselves.
I would say that the GBA plus, like, it is an underlying issue in a lot of policies that we don't actually realize that are being debated right now, like Bill C-69. The environmental bill has a component in it in terms of gender-based GBA plus analysis, in terms of the provisions in there to improve, or at least it's proposing to improve, how Indigenous people are consulted and participating in the review of major projects. So these proposals have been there. You know, whether the proposals are complete enough or whether they've been debated, I don't think they have, but these issues are on the table, and we haven't necessarily seen a full debate of what has been proposed, what could make it better, or whether there are areas to improve.
So on the same subject, I want to read a quote on Quebec's Bill 21 that was written by Tejpal Singh Swatch, who's an Edmonton-based accountant, and he was writing for the CBC earlier this week, and he said, in practice, it is discrimination against people in turbans, hijabs, kippahs, and other religious symbols. Yet federal leaders have offered little more than craven platitudes, and only when pressed. Does it seem incongruous? Mike, I'll start with you, and Natasha, you want to weigh in. Does it seem incongruous, or maybe just expected, that none of the leaders want to deal with Bill 21 and the discrimination that many people say that they're facing, people leaving the province because they can't teach there or have a public service job there?
Well, it's all, yeah, Jagmeet Singh this weekend on Tout le monde en parle, actually, I think, backing away from the possibility of intervening if he were elected. So yes, all the leaders are kind of afraid to weigh into this issue directly. The federal government, I think, would have some powers to intervene with its own legislation or to participate in legal challenges. And yeah, they don't want to, but yeah, I've seen, having grown up in Quebec, I've seen how politicians deal with issues in Quebec, and how sometimes there is a fear to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Tasha,
with the number of seats up for grabs in Quebec, unfortunately, I'm not surprised that the parties are taking these positions. The Bloc Québécois, and you know, you get into the horse race, but they're doing much better than they have been in the last year. And because of that, all parties, all Federalist parties, are nervous, and they do not want to, you know, go on this road. And I think that is also a missed opportunity, because I do believe, I mean, Bill 21 definitely targets people of racial minorities. I mean, I was sitting next to a woman on an airplane just a week ago who was exactly in that situation. She had done her PhD in biochemistry. She had a husband. They had moved from Egypt 8 years ago to Quebec to settle there. And she had a hijab on, and she had brown skin. And she said, you know, she goes, if I get a job somewhere else, I'm going to move. And she had been educated in Quebec by the Quebec taxpayer, and she was a contributing citizen, a wonderful person from what I could gather in our conversation. This is the reality of Bill 21, and the parties will not touch it, and I think that is shameful, quite frankly, that they will not. But the reality is they don't want to lose potential seats, especially outside the region of Montreal, and this is where a lot of the battles in Quebec City and other parts of the province are taking place. So that is why we're seeing what we are.
Jennifer?
I don't know that there's much more I can add on that. I mean, I would say the Quebec premier recently, you know, kind of issued a dare almost, right? And I'm sure that no party leader really wants to take him up on that dare in terms of the debate. I would say, I mean, what I've heard from the major parties is sort of they're not necessarily closing the door to intervening, but they're certainly not willing at this stage to commit. You know, and that's, I think you're right. I think it is a missed opportunity. And the saying that they personally disagree, but they're not necessarily going to take action, tends to reinforce those systemic barriers, right?
So one more thing on this topic. We really can't discuss Indigenous policy without talking about systemic racism in Canada. The Indian Act back in 1876 was deliberately put in place to erase Indigenous language, culture, history, law, viewed as a sort of lesser than the white system. And of course, today we see Indigenous people are still vastly overrepresented in the prison system. Access to education, healthcare, social services is not equal to what other Canadians receive. Mike, during this campaign, and you did touch on Bill C-69, but have you noticed what is the quality of the discussion, I guess, is what I wanted to ask you, around Indigenous policy so far? We're 2 weeks into the
Yeah, probably not as deep as it should be, and it's complicated. And I would say in general the population hasn't fully understood or hasn't fully been educated about history, about the systemic issues. There was this moment during the debate where there was a discussion about major energy projects I mean, I think most of you might have heard these comments about holding hostage that were raised by one of the leaders. So that kind of view, I think that this view, based on the reporting that I've done and the feedback that I get from people across the country, there is perhaps a misunderstanding of what it means to consult, what it means to engage and respect First Nations. So that, you know, that's a part of the debate that we could explore more as a country. We could explore more what the United Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People actually means, whether it is practical to apply it here and how the best way to apply it would be in terms of major projects that want to be done.
Thank you. I want to move on to tax system issues and a lot of promises made towards families. It seems a lot of the platform announcements so far have centered around what we would call in the media pocketbook issues or affordability, and also a lot of it directed at young families. So just to start, what do we make of this frame, this affordability frame that has emerged in the first 2 weeks of the campaign? Jennifer, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, it seems to poll well, but I'm having a bit of a hard time in terms of finding empirical evidence for affordability crunches, or at least understanding what that might actually mean on the ground. So, I tried to do a bit of a dive on this. If you're on Twitter, there's a whole bunch of graphs waiting for you to go and explore and play with if you want.
You must follow Jennifer during this campaign. I have to say, I'm like, I'll go online. What is Jennifer saying about this?
So I just want to say, the data that we have on this basically says, there are small numbers, important, but small numbers of Canadians who are falling behind on their bill payments or missing their housing payments, right? There's sort of a bigger chunk of Canadians, about one-third, who don't have the kind of liquid savings that they would be able to fall back on in case of an emergency or to handle like some big lumpy payment. But when you actually look at things like, are we paying more than our household incomes at the average, there's some, like, a lot of the numbers are actually either flat or slightly declining. And yeah, you know, families with young kids do certainly face cost challenges that other households do not, namely childcare. Right? But the evidence on this stuff is actually pretty mixed when you're getting down to, like, what do the numbers say in terms of affordability? Hmm.
Tasha, why are we hearing this frame right now?
I haven't crunched the numbers. I just know that housing prices, which I track because I just bought a house and I had to for the past year, in major areas such as Toronto, Vancouver, and now even in Prince Edward Island, in Charlottetown, they've gone through the roof. They've almost doubled in a year in PEI, believe it or not. So this is something that people are facing. Housing is becoming, I think, the biggest affordability, which explains why you saw the recent housing affordability announcements, extensions of mortgage times, and we're going to talk about that, I know, in our conversation specifically. But the affordability frame, I think, I'm not surprised that it is out there. And it's not just for the people with young kids, but it's the notion that the middle class is falling behind. And it's kind of the opposite of what we saw in the last election, where it was very positive towards the middle class. Now we're being told that we're not doing as well after 4 years, a little strange. But at the same time, I think that there is that sense of anxiety people have and when they feel that. And in fact, this is the first year that in 10 years that the average net worth of a Canadian has actually decreased. People are using their savings to pay down debt instead of investing them. And that shows that people are nervous about debt. They've accumulated too much. So I think this anxiety is what the parties are playing on. Even if the numbers don't necessarily fully back it out, there's a fear out there.
Mike?
Yeah, I think if jobs are being created and maybe there is growth in the economy, the underlying feeling, I think across the country, is people feel they have less money to spend, and probably because of housing. I'm in the process of moving right now from Gatineau, Quebec, to Toronto, and you know, seeing housing costs more than double. I know firsthand. I have less money in my pocket now, so I'm looking to see what politicians can do. I'm lucky actually, but I think that politicians are speaking to this issue. That's what I think that I hear them saying that. And I think if you look at what happened in the last U.S. election, that was a big issue in terms of what the president was speaking to in all the language that he was using. He was appealing to people who felt they were left behind, and politicians now, if they want to win, they have to find a way to speak to those people in a way that they're promising to put more money in their pockets.
Mm-hmm. So if we look at the bigger tax promises, the Liberals are promising to increase the basic personal amount up to $15,000 by 2023-24. The Conservatives over the same time frame are promising a universal tax cut with the tax rate on income under $47,000 reduced by 1.25 percentage points, both plans costing about $6 billion. So I want to start with those two parties first. Jennifer, what do you think we should understand about the Liberal and Conservative approaches to these big tax cuts? And
right.
What are the differences between those two proposals important?
Okay, so some similarities, some differences. Number one, they both come in at about the same fiscal cost at maturity, about somewhere between $5.5 and $6 billion a year. That's not insignificant. The design actually here really, really matters for those of you who are not tax nerds. Basically, if you think about the cut to the bottom bracket, right, what is that going to do? Well, that's going to reduce the statutory tax rate on the first $47,000 of income. It also reduces the value of all those non-refundable tax credits, like the volunteer firefighters tax credit and the age amount and all that sort of stuff. So those also come down. But then what that means is that it carries through, because this one isn't capped for upper income people, right? So it carries through all of those other sort of stepwise, parts of the tax system, which means that actually the net effect in terms of the dollar value of the savings for people is actually tends to be higher, right, in sort of the upper middle ranges of income earners. The basic personal amount instead is sort of saying, okay, here's a set of income, a dollar value of income that you get to claim that you don't have to pay tax on at that lowest marginal rate. The Liberals have designed it in such a way that it's also capped, so people who are in those upper tax brackets aren't able to claim it. So the net effect is that the Liberal design is a little bit more progressive. But what I would say is that the other thing they share in common is neither of the parties have really explained why we need tax cuts at this point, when taxes right now are sitting at 15% of GDP in terms of, federal revenues are sitting at about 15% of GDP, which is about where we left them, in 2008 and have had them steadily. So it's not like sort of, the tax burden in Canada has been rising exponentially. It's also not entirely clear that they've painted the picture that this is the way to fix that mythical affordability challenge, right? So some similarities, some important differences in terms of distribution.
So we had, on that point, we had an event on the tax system in January, which some of you might have been, and Alison Christians, who's from a tax lawyer from McGill, she was making the case that our political leaders never tell people that taxes are a good thing. They're always saying that you want to cut them. On that note, the NDP is promising a wealth tax of 1% on wealth over 20 million and a boost to the top marginal tax rate. And the Greens are proposing a guaranteed livable income, which would upend big portions of the tax system as it would get rid of a range of income supports. Tasha, what do you make of the focus on tax cuts? I think I know where your general thinking is on this, but is it supported by evidence that we need this for the economy? Is it just something that the parties say because they want our votes?
Well, parties always say things that want our votes. But in terms of tax cuts, when you do look at, for example, we take Ontario as an example, Mike Harris tax cuts did precede an era of great economic growth. It also did cut back on services, particularly in areas like health and education, where people felt that they were receiving less services perhaps, but it goes hand in hand with the idea that the state is less responsible and some of that responsibility is given to the individual to be able to use that money for their own needs. And that goes to the affordability piece. So yes, there has been, in the United States as well, there was evidence after the Reagan tax cuts that you saw then subsequent administrations reaping the benefits of that. I mean, Bill Clinton reaped the benefits essentially and then actually engaged in welfare reform of his own, pushed by the Republicans. But still, reducing the size of the state does have a benefit in terms of freeing up capital for people to deploy in the economy. The question is how it's deployed. So, of course, if the tax cuts are spent on certain things, if people will spend that revenue on certain items that stimulate the economy more than others, you will have a greater benefit. So the question is, again, what are people doing with that money? If they're just paying down debt, for example, that tax cut is not necessarily going to stimulate the economy as much as if they were going out, to buy a fridge or buy something that was produced. So it remains to be seen whether these tax cuts will do what they say they want for the economy. But certainly they make people feel, and they will help address that affordability gap. It does go hand in hand. People will get the sense that, yes, I have more money to be able to, buy those lessons for my child. And in fact, that's one of the areas that I should mention too, is this targeted tax cut, the boutique tax cuts. The Conservatives are returning to that for things like transit cuts, or other tax credits for transit, tax credits for kids' lessons and this kind of thing, because they know that stimulates people's voters' appetite for their party, if not for perhaps for the economy as much, but it makes you want to vote for them. So
in policy options, Eugene Lang, who works at Queen's Policy School, right after the writ drop, he wrote an article about recessions and the campaigns, and he said, "We will be told we have butter and guns, lower taxes, shrinking deficits, and all matter of federal spending initiatives paid for chiefly by a growing economy and the revenues it generates for federal coffers." So he was trying to make the point that nobody wants to talk about a recession during a federal campaign, even though if you open the paper on every given day, there's an article about, are we heading for a recession? And my good friend Heather Schofield at the Toronto Star has pointed out all the parties seem to have also at the same time taken aim at the corporate sector and subsidies and corporate taxes. Both the NDP and the Greens would like to reverse corporate tax cuts. Are we, in this campaign, are we missing a whole conversation about the general health of the economy, whether we're girding for a recession? Are we sort of living in this kind of fantasy world of tax cuts and spending, whereas we could be heading over the cliff, and I don't know when. It's a big question, but Mike, maybe I'll start with you.
Well, I think in general, in all campaigns, we fail to look mid to long term. I mean, our system is designed to look 4 years ahead. Not only on economy, but on issues like climate. I mean, which also has an economic has economic implications. So, if you want to look long term, the global economy, there are a number of things, that the parties have not fully addressed. In all the policies we see, in terms of whether they are costed or not, all the parties say that they've costed their platforms, but have they looked holistically at every impact of their policies? Probably not. We could do a little bit more there in digging.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue is what provokes the recession. And we saw in Canada, the last recession was provoked by falling oil prices. So this is something that the government has no control over. So I'm not surprised that they wouldn't necessarily go there. I mean, the international monetary crisis as well. I mean, Canada did very well pulling ourselves out of that by engaging the federal government, actually, and backstopping banks and large amounts of spending, went into deficit, which was not something a conservative government would, on the face of it, want to do. But I think that to talk about a recession is a negative thing. Mm-hmm. And campaigns, this campaign started off as a campaign of fear, and it still slightly is going there against, the conservatives, especially in Ontario, the Ford factor, the fear factor is equating one party with another. If you get cheer in, you'll have lots of cuts is sort of the message. That fear is being used to coalesce people, but it's less a fear of economic downturn, it's a fear of the other guy. And I think it's easier for parties to demonize their opponents rather than the economic system.
I just wanted to jump in and say that, the global projections around where is the economy, global economy headed from the IMF have been downgraded now twice in the last year. Canada has been, downgraded once, but we're staying steady at this point at, kind of a more modest rate of growth. So even if you think in terms of, the short-term projections, right, if you believe that tax cuts actually have a stimulative effect on the economy, then is it wise, is it prudent to actually be releasing those tax cuts before it's clear whether or not we're going into a recession? And I agree that there is also some concern that the more you say the word recession, the more likely that it actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's almost like a Monty Python or Fawlty Towers kind of skit. Like, don't talk about it anyway. So I do wonder whether or not it actually is wise, right, for parties to be coming forward and essentially saying, like, we're not going to hold our powder. We're not even going to wait and see what happens. We're not going to give ourselves that room in terms of potential need for fiscal stimulus, because we know that people, individual consumers, are actually responsive to signals in terms of marginal changes in price. So if you've already changed the price, if you've already lowered taxes, you've now left yourself less room to handle things when and if the recession takes effect. The other thing I would say is that none of the parties, granted it's early days, right? We're still only in day 15. My God, does it ever feel longer already? But none of the parties have so far really kind of made it clear how they plan to pay for the tax cuts that they're proposing. I added it up. I think the Conservatives are now at somewhere in the neighborhood of about $9 billion in tax cuts in total. And that's, cumulative stuff from the boutique tax credits, the broad-based stuff, as well as the changes to the taxation on corporations that they've promised. It's not clear, right, where is the new revenue coming from or what's going to be cut.
The other thing that we haven't talked much about are the trends in the economy, Mike, automation, more gig workers, more green jobs, transition to green jobs, the shift to intangibles in the economy, like data as a commodity, with fewer workers, need for fewer workers. So all this might ultimately mean a much smaller tax base from which to draw. What have you heard from the party so far, if much, on this particular side of the economy?
I think both the NDP and the Greens have talked about either through regulation or taxation of some of the internet companies that are whether they be Netflix, the social media companies that are, you know, either selling products without charging taxes. These are aspects, you know, as the economy shifts to the sharing economy or gig economy, that there are a lot of players coming in that are not being taxed in the same way as Canadian companies. So there's an exploration there. The two larger parties, I think, have been reluctant to go there. There's one really fascinating policy that I saw in the Green Party platform about, and I don't exactly know how it's going to work from the way they've worded it, but they've talked about adding more taxes to large corporations to compensate for the decline in taxes collected, income taxes collected from workers who are losing their jobs. So that tax would apply only to large corporations, not to small businesses. It needs to be explained a bit further, but it's an interesting, I mean, it's an attempt to address the issue, but it hasn't quite been to
me. Fewer people. Yeah. I was going to add there, I think that sort of big picture is, it's similar to the recession conversation, the big picture of how the workforce is changing, the fact that automation is stealing, quotes and quotes, or taking people's jobs, replacing them, and people are moving to this gig economy, is something the government is not talking about because it doesn't quite have a handle on it. None of the parties are talking about it anyway, because it is something that, again, it's slightly beyond their control, and the policy response to it isn't really clear. I mean, would you change the tax system to, I mean, Elizabeth, I don't think that policy makes much sense, but to try and find the money that's out there that's not being put into your coffers. We know a Netflix tax was incredibly unpopular because people say, well, you know, it's going to come to me. It's going to be passed through. And that is, nobody wants it to be, no party wants to give the impression they're going to be taxing you by taxing the company that's providing that service, because that's the link they will make. So I think they're behind on this one, as parties are always behind dealing with technology, but it probably does deserve a larger space in the campaign.
On that point on the Netflix tax, do you think that the paradigm has changed a little bit since the last election, in the sense that there's far more negativity towards big tech than there was 4 years ago, well, 8 years ago?
Bill, too, that that is the most naked, shameless appeal for votes. Well, cut your cell phone bill. Really? How? So, you know, you're going to force companies to just cut the bill. That one, it's popular, though, because everyone has a cell phone. So the Liberals know people will respond to it. But I think it's incredibly irresponsible policy.
Yeah, and we all see the ads from the U.S. where they get, you know, their cell phone cheap for $20 a month for unlimited data. Yes. there's also a range of what we would call, and we mentioned this, Tashman, this boutique tax credits. A lot of them proposed by the Conservative Party. So a return to the fitness credit, the arts credit, the transit credit. But the Liberals have introduced, I think, in the last budget or a couple budgets ago, a teacher's tax credit. Why do you think that this remains such a popular tool? Even though there's a lot of, if you read economists, they're not so crazy about this, right?
No, it's not so crazy in general about that. So why are these so popular? A couple of different reasons. So number one, I think that there's a belief, right, that for politicians to feel like they are delivering a policy that has a direct connection with voters. This is one way to do it. It allows for micro-targeting. Voters get to feel a little bit of a sense of reward when they fill out their annual tax return and get to check that box to claim their credit. But if you actually look at the net effect of these, right, I mean, I'm not saying that every single tax credit is a bad idea, but you've got to think on balance. Are we better off actually paying people like a cash check up front, or is it more efficient to deliver these things through the tax system? And a lot of cases, when it comes to things like making children's arts programming more affordable, it's an insane way to try and actually deliver that promise, right, in terms of lowering the effective cost of arts programming for kids. Because if you think about it from the household perspective, they got to front the money first of all, pay for all the lessons, and then at the end of the year claim some portion of that back. That doesn't actually do anything in terms of changing relative prices at the time that the bills have to be paid or increase the supply in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is also attractive to federal parties because it lets them skirt having to deal with provinces, right? if it's a tax credit, you don't have to negotiate with provinces, including difficult ones at the moment, right, around how are we going to do this cost-shared spending program that might actually create a greater supply of things like children's rights programming, if that's what you really care about. So I think there are a lot of reasons that they do it. It is striking to me how much, though, of what's been promised so far in this campaign is like it's nostalgic. It's like people are, you know, parties are wishing it was back in, like, 2014 or something.
To piggyback on that, boutique tax credits are driven by data, and they're driven by who's voting for you. And so if you look at where, for example, the Conservatives are looking for votes, and the suburban families who take the GO train, who take transit, for example, or have their kids in programs, or who, you know, feel they really should get out to the gym more, they're targeting voter bases based on the data they have, and that's what these targets are for. They don't necessarily, I agree with you, get people to the gym. And a lot of people don't even use them, but the idea that they're out there is something that's appealing because it seems like the party is talking to you. And so you are more likely to think that party has your interest at heart in a general sense, even if you don't use the tax credit.
So, Tasha, we touched on it very briefly about that, all of the goodies on housing. The Conservatives and the NDP would like to increase the amortization period on insured mortgages to 30 years. The Liberals would expand the first-time homebuyer incentive. Are these good ideas?
The extension of the amortization, no. In fact, that was rolled back, I believe, by the Conservatives because it encourages debt, which is one of the biggest problems Canadians have, the whole affordability piece. Debt is underpinning all that. We are incredibly indebted, and that is just stretching your debt. It's not helping you address the actual root of the debt, which is either you're buying too much house or the house is too expensive for where you want to buy it. And this is something people don't want to talk about much. It's that, you know, everyone thinks they want to be able to afford a house in a certain place, and we can't do that anymore. Demand is such that in major markets you can't. I think, though, the affordability piece, the second policy that you were talking about, I think that maybe there's some value to it, but I think that people generally... housing is an issue that is not dealt with at a macro level. I mean, the federal government tinkering with the stress test, for example, actually hurt a lot of people and made it harder for them to afford a house. So sometimes when government acts at that level, it's more of a regional or local level. Housing is, there are hot markets and not. So if you have a blanket policy, it can actually hurt some markets very much.
So I'm going to move on to another big policy area that was kind of quiet until this week, and that's climate change and the environment. So on Friday, there's going to be the climate strike come to cities across Canada. The UN Secretary General's climate summit happened this week. The Liberals came out with the broad strokes of a renewed policy on climate change, although it was pretty vague. And we've heard already from the Conservatives before the campaign, and of course the Greens and the NDP both have their policies published right at the beginning of the campaign. So Mike, you've been following energy and the environment for many years. What stands out for you so far from what you've read from the different parties on their platforms?
What's missing, probably.
Okay. You know,
A few months ago, the Bank of Canada for the first time it listed climate change in its list of financial risks to the Canadian economy. And they talked about it at the time. I mean, it's been years in the making because some other central banks have already started to do this, and maybe the Bank of Canada is catching up. But they talked about the risk of fire sales causing a crisis in markets. They talked about the fact that not only consumers but investors are also turning away from investments in sectors that are whether they be fossil fuels, whether they be carbon intensive. I was on a farm in Saskatchewan about 6 weeks ago and was talking to a cattle rancher who was saying that, you know, they don't see raising cattle as being productive in the future because they sense that these things like Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger, these are not fads. These are trends that consumers are starting to drive and push. So there is a significant absence in terms of the discussion we've had, in terms of what the parties have introduced to try to tackle these issues. You know, I think that there's there's a discussion now about just transition and about shifting the economy. I think in what the Liberals introduced yesterday, they've been afraid to talk about how they've talked about a just transition for the coal industry, but they've been afraid to address this for political reasons and for fear of backlash in Western Canada. But they talked about a Just Transition Act yesterday. I don't know what that is or what will be in
so
that
away
Just
from
Transition
the fossil
Act?
Fuel industry to green jobs or other jobs. Is that what it means?
Yeah, but it requires a policy where you have to find ways to support the workers that are inevitably going to be in industries that will no longer exist if we're going to be net zero, if the planet is actually going to continue operating in a way that's livable. By 2050, scientists say that we have to be net zero or we have to be close to it. So that kind of economy, unless you have a magic way to capture carbon from tailpipes and cars, there's a whole shift that has to take place. And that means the people who are producing oil and gas, who are working, more than hundreds of thousands of people across the country that are working in these industries, you have to find ways to support them as these jobs disappear, and finding ways to train them. So whether it's improving EI and allowing and encouraging training, and a lot of there is discussion in some of the platforms about requiring payroll taxes. I think the NDP has talked about a 1% payroll tax, as you have in Quebec right now for companies that have to spend 1% of 1% of someone's salary on training. These sorts of ideas, I mean, there's, we talk about boutique tax credits. I think we have boutique climate policies in a lot of the party platforms right now. And we do need something more comprehensive in terms of addressing what scientists, what economists say we need to do.
So there seems to be so far a consensus on the center and center left around carbon pricing. The Conservatives are still obviously against carbon pricing. Is there any hope, you think, of some kind of cross-partisan consensus at any point on this to move forward?
On carbon pricing? Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll see it in this election. I don't think that the Conservatives are on that road. They've made it very clear in their policy they are in favor of developing technology versus increasing taxes. And I think it's a road that, in fact, I think it actually is a road they could do more on, because I think the Liberals actually have gone on that one a little bit now as well. They've said, we're going to incentivize production of technologies as well. They're going to give, I think it's a 50% reduction in taxes to companies who will be producing new carbon capture or green technologies. So they recognize that, the private sector has to drive. There has to be a substitute there. There has to be something that consumers can actually turn to replace the oil and gas that they currently use. I mean, it's a fallacy to say everyone get an electric car if there's no car stations anywhere. So,
but if there's no market pressure for them to buy
the problem is that the Liberals' plan on carbon taxes as well is a bit of a Swiss cheese, because you've got so many exemptions for various industries who want to, they say, well, I can't do this within a period of a certain number of years. You've got to reduce for me. And then the other industries will say, yes, well, what about us? So you have a situation where, there are carbon taxes, but you also have ways of, I would say, exempting yourself, but the government will recognize your industry needs a longer period to transition, et cetera, et cetera. So you end up with a patchwork, essentially, of carbon taxes. And that, and again, for the individual, the consumer, then the consumer who gets a rebate from the government, in Ontario's case, what is the incentive to use less carbon-intensive products if you are getting a rebate? The Conservatives will say, and you can argue with me here, I know, and you will, but the Conservatives will say, look, it's going to increase the cost of living beyond which what the average person can bear. And that's because it's not just, the taxes you pay on oil and gas. It's everything else that is using transportation or manufacture that is affected by the carbon taxes. So it does have an economic cost. And balancing that, especially in voters' minds, voters don't, they love the environment. They don't want to pay for it. Every poll tells us the same thing.
Mm-hmm. People, the Public Policy Forum had a recent
poll. How do you solve that conundrum in voters' minds?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, 100% agree on that. There is, you know, there is an appetite for carbon pricing and for climate change action as long as somebody else pays for it. I would say, so Andrew Leach has a wonderful explainer on how it is that actually having the carbon price, even with the rebate, will actually make a difference here. And the bottom line is, because if you price all of the goods, then the relative cost of the less carbon intensive goods will fall. Right. So notwithstanding the fact that you're getting some rebate, you're interested in buying things that are cheaper because there's a new price on the other more carbon intensive goods. That's, I mean, it's just pretty straightforward that way. I would say, though, that, I mean, all of the parties have a price on carbon in some way, shape or form. So even though the Conservative Party is saying that they're against carbon pricing, their regulatory regime is de facto a price on carbon. We just don't know what it is, right? And you're putting government in the position of dictating market mechanisms in terms of how emitters should actually be adapting their business practices and production. The NDP is also in a kind of a funny position in terms of, like, I get it in terms of where their voter base is, but they're also proposing things like a national automotive strategy, which I know they're saying this is about transitioning the Canadian economy to lower emission vehicles and becoming a world leader and that kind of thing. But all of the parties kind of have this thing where they have these sort of carve-outs for some sort of heavy emitter, and actually all of them have some form of carbon pricing. Some are just clearer than others.
So health... all these big, big policy areas. So far, it's kind of curious, but the only big item on healthcare that's really been discussed is pharmacare. The NDP wants to introduce it immediately and fund it to the tune of $10 billion annually. And healthcare, of course, continues to be one of the top issues that are identified by Canadians as their key issue. Is there anything that we should take away from the promises that we've heard on this to date on pharmacare?
Well, I think that pharmacare is the sort of the new frontier, if you will, because we have universal Medicare. So what else can you make universal at this point? If you want to make anything, it's going to be pharmacare. Yes, drug prices have gone up significantly, continue to go up, especially, and this is the thing, for certain drugs, if you look at the United States, that is the closest, I guess, window we have to another healthcare system. And you see people there who can't afford their insulin coming to Canada to buy it. This fear of not being able to afford life-sustaining medications is very real for some people. So we look at that. We don't want to have that situation in Canada. Is pharmacare the way to go? The provinces were certainly heading in that direction. So the federal, there's very little risk for federal parties to say, let's have pharmacare, except the reality is that there are many people who have the equivalent of pharmacare through their employers. And the impact on that industry, on the insurance industry, on all that, is not really being factored in. Rather than having universal pharmacare, why not have a more targeted type of pharmacare? Because universal jives with our view of healthcare in this country. And I think that's why the parties have gone there on this one, even if economically it doesn't necessarily make the most sense.
Should we find it a bit weird that no one's talked about the health escalator, the healthcare transfer escalator, yeah, which you know, has been a big bone of contention with the provinces under Harper and then under Trudeau. We kept the escalator at 3.5%.
Yeah.
Why isn't anyone talking about that?
Because there's no money.
There's no money because they've spent it all on other things. Is that basically the bottom line on that?
Well, yeah, I think so. I wanted to jump into on the pharmacare issue that if all the political parties are really concerned about Quebec, it's quite interesting. This is not really an issue in Quebec because there is a drug insurance plan in Quebec right now. And yeah, what's missing in this debate is in terms of working with the other provinces. You know, if the Liberals say they want to introduce pharmacare, and meantime you have a leader who is attacking some of the provincial premiers, that is going to be a difficult task to implement. But yeah, like, I mean, there has been little said about money that could be spent to improve or boost the funding for the provinces. And yeah, I think that if there were promises and they were costed, it would be difficult for any of the parties to deliver on that after the election.
Policy areas that we haven't heard about. What jumps out at you? One thing that struck me was that there's very little on foreign policy and trade. Is that surprising at all?
I don't know if it's that surprising, considering that there was some criticism of the way the government handled NAFTA 2.0, CUSMA, USMA, whatever you want to call it. Then that sort of died down. There was a little bit of that at the beginning of the campaign. But I think that overall, foreign policy to me is sort of the Achilles heel of this government, which may explain why the Liberals decided to eschew the Monk debate on foreign policy, because contrary to the last time, they are on the defensive about it, and it's not necessarily their brightest spot. Mm-hmm. So I think that foreign policy never also really runs elections. It's never really a ballot question. So I think that is why you don't really see a lot of it, even though it is very important.
Mm-hmm. I think if the trade negotiations with the United States and Mexico were still ongoing, that might be a different story. But tend to agree. It's not, generally speaking, kind of a ballot box question.
Mm. Mike, anything that's jumped out at you that hasn't been raised?
I don't think I have anything to add on that.
Yeah.
I would say, though, I haven't heard an awful lot about indigenous policy, and mm-hmm. I do find that
this is true.
Disappointing.
Yeah, there's been very little on indigenous policy. Should the Liberals and the Conservatives had shared their platforms up front? We still have this weird situation where people want to release their policy in dribs and drabs. The Greens and the NDP, God bless them, because I can just go to your site and read your platform, put them out right away. So do we think this is an old thing that should be scrapped, or does it make sense still?
I think if you're going into a campaign, if you're going into leaders' debates and you don't have a platform, that does make it difficult for members of the public to evaluate mm-hmm. and decide. So I would be in favor, of seeing the platform right at the beginning from all parties. Mm.
I find it ironic that the Liberal Party is not costing out, same way the other parties are relying on the POB to cost out their platforms before the election. And I think they're maybe taking a cue, bizarrely, from Doug Ford in Ontario, who didn't cost out his platform at all during the election and won. So I'm not sure. I'm a little disappointed in terms of the accountability. And like you said, how are you going to pay for the tax cuts and other things that you're promising us?
I don't know. Look, historically, we actually had a long time in Canada where we didn't even have written election platforms. We got used to this kind of in the mid-90s of having people come out with their blue book or the red book or the yellow book, whatever, your color book. I'm a bit agnostic as to, when it should come out. Some parties like to do it even before the writ drops. What I would say is this, is that before the election day, important time before election day, I'll let you decide what that means for you. I would like to see not only the full list of all the promises, but also the full costing. And, I think it's still early enough days. Although the written platforms are out for both the NDP and Greens, I don't know what a lot of those promises are going to cost, because they don't actually have their costing out. I suspect that, the parties like the Conservatives and the Liberals who are coming out with promises that have numbers attached, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that even if the PBO isn't necessarily releasing costing on particular things, that maybe the PBO services are still being used. So I'm willing to wait and see.
So last question. If you had the opportunity to draft a question for the first English language debate, what would it be?
So I always worry that parties are drafting platform ideas where they haven't necessarily thought through implementation. They sort of say, whatever, details, that's a winner's problem. So at the same time, believe it or not, the evidence is pretty clear that in power, elected parties try really, really hard to actually implement what they're running on, or at least make it look like they've implemented what they're running on. So I would want to be asking about implementation and ask the leaders, where are the pieces in your platform where you're most worried about implementation, and how are you going to communicate to Canadians if and when you're having a hard time keeping your commitment?
Tasha?
I would address an issue that hasn't really been discussed much at all, which is federalism and the rifts that have appeared in our country over energy policy in particular. And I would say, how are you going to reconcile climate policy and energy policy in a way that helps also keep the country together?
Great one. We like it at the IRPP.
I think I like that so much, I'm gonna second what Tasha said.
I have one too. This is what mine would be. Find out what each of the leaders will do to try to build a cross-party consensus on climate action, which actually is part of the Green platform. But let's give a warm thank you to our panel. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much to Mike D'Souza, Tasha Carradine, Jennifer Robson, and Jennifer Ditchburn. for tackling the emerging policy themes of the 2019 election. Thanks as well to the Max Bell School of Public Policy for partnering with Policy Options on this series of events, to CBC for sponsoring the series, and to CPAC for broadcasting this first event. If you'd like to get in touch with us at the podcast, you can shoot us an email at policyoptions@irpp.org, or you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn under the handle @IRPP. Our next two events are almost sold out, so if you'd like to snag a ticket, head to policyoptions.irpp.org. I'm Julie Buchel. Thanks so much for listening.